It's a great pleasure to be here. I want to actually start by thanking KITP and the organizers putting together what's been so far a great program and has many more great weeks ahead of us. And I also wanted to, you know, thank the explorers who decided that San Francisco, that this sort of greater West Coast area was a good place to settle. Because it's really thought-provoking and wonderful to step outside and have this beautiful environment around us. Before I go into this Blackboard discussion, and I do mean to make this a discussion, a dialogue, not a monologue, I wanted to get a sense of how many biologists are in the room. Okay, so we have a few. I wasn't certain. I'm glad you've come. Thank you. And then I guess the other crucial question to sort of establish a baseline is how many people are comfortable with lots of squiggly lines on the board? Okay, yeah.
My little daughter is pretty.
Okay, so we'll say somewhere between evolutionary biology and squiggly lines and see exactly where we get. So the Dense Light program that I'm a part of is focused on a very simple but challenging question, which is, can one build systems where photons, light, are the sort of constituent particles of the system, and yet they can interact, propagate, and behave in ways that require solving complex many-body problems to understand them? And let's say that we've achieved those bits and pieces, so we made it, took a simple system, which is photons, I'll explain in a moment, made it very hard, then you'll next ask the question, what can you learn having developed these sort of engineered complicated systems? And so we're setting ourselves up for a problem, hoping to learn something new, anywhere from a new technological innovation to something new about how the universe really behaves. And where possible, I'll try and motivate these ideas. Obviously, I won't have an opportunity to go into too much detail in any one of them, but I'd like this to be a dialogue, which means questions are encouraged, so much so that I may ask you questions, and don't hesitate to answer. So I'd like to start with why we're talking about photons. And part of the motivation is that it's actually really easy experimentally to work with light. As anyone who's run an undergraduate lab knows, lasers are relatively cheap. Mirrors, lenses, and other dielectric optics are pretty easy to work with. And one of the amazing properties of these systems are that as the light travels, it maintains its quantum mechanical properties. So in some sense, light is the easiest natural quantum mechanical phenomena all around us. Perhaps not surprisingly, this is why the birth of quantum mechanics was really the story of understanding photons. The other thing that we really like about photons is that you can control them quite well with modern nanofabrication techniques. So as an example case of what I mean by this control, you can imagine that if I have a set of mirrors, which I draw as these sort of spherical reflectors, that I can have standing waves of light in the system that bounce back and forth between the mirrors. We won't get into microwave optics yet. So this light bouncing back and forth between the mirrors has some standing waves associated with it. We call this type of thing a cavity because it represents some boundary conditions that define the volume of space. And as physicists, we like to label this thing as some sort of a harmonic oscillator, because light is a harmonic oscillator at some fundamental level. And so we describe it by some operator A, an object which basically destroys photons. And it was actually a crucial insight in quantum optics in the early 60s to realize that all this talk about particles and waves is kind of not the point. The point is that the photon, this particle-like thing in the theory of light and matter, is the thing that your photodetector detects. So in some sense, we talk about particles because we can build devices that detect them. So this is the thing that destroys a photon. And now, I have some photon bouncing back and forth in this object here. But I can put another one nearby. And as you know, when I have light near the surface of some piece of dielectric, it doesn't disappear. It sort of just decays off as an evanescent field. And so you can imagine there's a little bit of light field that goes in the middle here and then comes across the other side. So the photon that started here can hop over here via this evanescent wave coupling between them. So if I start to try and describe the dynamics of this system now with two cavities, looking at sort of a narrow band frequency near this resonances, I might write down some interaction in which I destroy a photon at site one, and then I put a dagger on this thing to tell me that I create a photon at site two. So if this is the thing that destroys photons, then there's a conjugate to it which creates photons. And these indices just label where we are in space. So the sort of kinesis matter theorists in the room immediately say, well, okay, so now you have a tight binding model. And actually, the chemists also might recognize this. The crucial point is that the excitation can move around in the system. And you can now start to engineer different behaviors by coupling up different cavities to each other. And cavities come in all sorts of different varieties. Right? So I drew this sort of canonical picture of two mirrors bouncing back and forth. But what about pillar? Well, that will confine electromagnetism just fine, pillar of dielectric material. What about a slab that performs a waveguide in this dimension and has holes in it? Well, each of these holes acts like its own little cavity. And you have something that's called a photonic crystal. You can even get very fancy and start talking about sort of so-called plasmons, which are tightly confined versions of these excitations, and ask the question, what about when a big molecule receives a photon? These are large circular sort of aromatic rings. A molecule comes in, a photon comes in, and it gets created. It creates an excitation in the system, which hops around. And you might recognize this as a sort of complex that is responsible for the gathering of light and photosynthesis. And in some sense, there's this huge amount of effort trying to reproduce phenomena like this, where you can control how the light moves around by controlling how things are coupled to each other. Now, if you put on your sort of physicist hat and ask the fundamentalist questions in this story, you can think it's kind of neat, right? You start with this gauge boson, which is just sort of defined because relativity requires it. And now you've started to modify how it behaves, and you're turning into a designer particle, even though it was pretty tightly constrained at the beginning. We're going to come back to this concept of designer particles in a little bit. Now, the thing about the photon is maybe not so obvious. So it can hop around. You can create it. You can destroy it. But it turns out the one thing photons don't really do is interact. Who'd care to venture a guess as to why photons don't interact? Oh, come on.
Charged particles are heavy.
Charged particles are heavy. Okay. So if you think back to the way that we understand the standard model, you understand that when I have a photon traveling around, the photon can spontaneously become an electron and an anti-electron pair. And then they can recombine back to themselves. So this is a photon which has an energy which is really, really small. Okay, so to give you a sense of the energy scale of the, well, actually, do I need to tell you the energy scale of a single photon? Is it apparent to you that it's really small? Okay. Now, the energy scale of a photon is really, really small. Let's say on the order of a millielectron volt, or 30 millielectron volts, or 100 millielectron volts. So that's some millielectron volts to electron volts range. In here, you have an electron, and an anti-electron, right? That is a rest mass energy, which is huge! So obviously, this type of diagram, which is not even an interaction yet, this is just a photon traveling and getting modified by the vacuum, is very, very weak. To turn into interaction, I have to have two photons coming in. And they create a pair and come back out. And that's going to be even more highly suppressed. You're going to pay a very, very expensive price if you want to get photons to interact. So people have calculated what it would take to see these effects in the lab. And there's some hope that if you look at the National Ignition Facility, where they're trying to get these lasers that make fusion happen, that if you get 4 orders of magnitude more power than the point where they get fusion really working, that you might start to see these processes turn on. That's like 10 to the 15 photons in a very, very tiny volume all at once. So that's going to be really hard. You know, fortunately, nature lets us cheat. Right, so we work actually in a world where there's lots of stuff around, matter. And as you know, when I've got matter, I have another option than just creating a particle and an antiparticle. So if you imagine I have some chunk of material with some electrons in it, which I'm going to draw as filled up levels in a Fermi C, if I hit this with a photon, I can create an electron up here and create a hole down here. This is the electron that gets promoted up there. So in an ordered material, or a photosynthetic complex, or a piece of dielectric, the antiparticle to the electron is a hole left behind in the ordered material. And now the energy scale is much more terrestrial. It's in the electron volt range. And so you start to get the ability to create interactions by having the photons interact with matter and having the matter interact with itself. And that's really the essence of how you develop interactions from these nominally non-interacting particles. And just in the same way that I could control where the photons propagate, now by controlling the material that they interact with and the structure of that material, I can make some progress. Please go ahead.
Something similar to what we all do for polaritons in semiconductor you're talking of. Of course, you can decide that the photons interact, but they interact through the fact that they are also two excitons.
Yes, that's exactly correct.
It's exactly that.
Yes, yes, yes. In fact, we're about to get there.
We do that for 20 years or something.
Yes, yes, yes. No, I mean, you know, the point is that this type of diagram I drew here, this is before we get to the excitons, I'll come to that in a second.
Yeah.
So this type of diagram I drew here, which I just have two photons come in and they make a pair and they go back out, that's what we call a care effect. But there are other effects you can get if you allow for bound particles of these electrons and holes. So the electrons are negatively charged and the holes are positively charged, so they want to come together. That object you would call an exciton. So you might think of, I'm going to draw the exciton as kind of like a electron hole pair like this with a little wiggle in between it, letting you know that it's bound together by the Coulomb force. And so now I can have photons come in and come out, and these excitons, which are these bound pairs of electron and a hole, can themselves interact. So this is an exciton-exciton interaction. And I think this is the first point where I might sort of dive briefly into something really neat that comes out of this story. And the thing is that photons don't interact, but photons dressed by matter do. And one way to make this work really well is to use matter that's very sensitive to light. And an example of matter that's very sensitive to light is a so-called quantum well structure. And in a quantum well structure, what you have is you have a sort of engineering of the local density of states of the material that allows you to create electron hole pairs that are tightly bound to each other. And they're very sensitive to light. So this is good technological applications. It means that you can start to use this type of material to build lasers. And in some sense, you could argue that a lot of the efforts and successes we've had in x-time polariton physics arise in part from efforts to make better chip-based laser systems. But the point there is that I have this light propagating. It produces this excitation of the medium, and then it goes back to light. And if the two excitations are too close to each other, they can interact. I could try to make a gas of these things by making a two-dimensional material, which is full of these sort of spin electron hole pairs in it that can be created. And then I put mirrors around it, like that. So light goes back and forth. Now what's going to happen is the light is going to interact with the matter. This interaction we're going to come back to in a moment. And if I have a photon here and then another photon coming by, which creates an excitation here, these two excitations are close enough to interact to each other because they're basically two dipoles that can run into each other, then the photons start to run into each other. And then you can actually get the photons to start to behave like an interacting gas. And this led to the first realization of a Bose-Einstein condensate, but with these polaritons, as they're called, the combined photon matter excitation. So the polariton is, by the way, a very fundamental concept to this field. And it represents the binding of the photon to the polarization of the material. So if any of you remember your electricity and magnetism, you have this displacement field D, which is electric field modified by the presence of the medium. So, you know, as physicists, we give it an actually working near resonance, so that's really a well-defined object. I want to go into more detail on this, but in just a moment, if you don't mind. So the thing about these photons that interact is they actually immediately have some applications. And I mentioned, of course, laser systems. Laser systems don't really work with the interactions so much. But there is something where you do work with the interactions, and that is what's called STED, which is a saturation technique for microscopy. And so now the biologists are nodding your heads, so they know what I'm talking about, right? So a canonical example of this sort of nonlinear diagram is that when I shine light on a material, it responds as an oscillator, right? That's the linear response. But if I shine more light, the oscillations become deformed because the binding of electron to its nuclear core is not a spring. It's only locally looks like a spring. As you stretch it more and more, it can eventually break off and be emitted. The consequence of that is if I shine light really strongly on a system, it will, for a brief period of time, behave differently. And that allows you to isolate small regions of space where you've already saturated the response of the medium, and it looks like vacuum again, so more light can come in, and you can see something else. That was, of course, the basis for a Nobel Prize just 2 years ago. So you can see that there's a kind of a hand-in-hand here, that the photons, we come at them in part because they're easy to get to experimentally. They have interesting open questions at the deepest level. We'll come to that one, the first big one, in a moment. But they also have immediate applications once you've learned something new about them. And that sort of cycle, virtuous cycle, of learning new things, using it to make new technology, but also learning new things about how you can do new things in the forms of understandings of the universe. And it kind of keeps going together. Okay, so let me tell you about how photons are interesting, even if you liked fermions a whole lot, and even if they don't have interactions. And this was one of the most surprising results when it comes to working with the photons in the last 10 years, and it's called boson sampling. So the thing about these photons, I mentioned that these linear optics, you know, lenses and mirrors, it's really easy to work with. It turns out one of the reasons it's really easy to work with is because you can exactly solve the quantum mechanics problem of how light propagates. It's called Maxwell's equations. And exactly solving Maxwell's equations is really saying that I have these operators, these things I described as sort of things that create and destroy photons, and I can write down equations in motion for them. So I have some vector of these operators. And the equation in motion turns out to be just some matrix that operates on that vector. So even though each of these harmonic oscillators has an infinitely large Hilbert space, and I have many such modes in a given box, let's say, I can still exactly solve this problem classically. And so you could say photons are really actually not that interesting because there's no open questions. You build a network of beam splitters, you put it into your ray tracer, plus diffractive corrections, and you know what's going to happen. Or if the diffractive corrections are good enough, you do a full simulation in Maxwell's equations, and you still know what's going to happen. But it turns out that knowing what happens to the modes of your theory, how the wave solutions propagate, is not the whole story, even in the non-interacting case. And there's a beautiful paper by Aronson and Awitz, which is called Boson Sampling. And it asks the question, how hard is it if I start with some series of different, say, fiber inputs to some complicated beam splitter system, and I put in sort of one photon in some of these inputs. So here I've got n photons, and I have m inputs. And then I want to know what's the probability if I put some photodetectors on the other side of this network. That they get a particular combination of photon numbers on the other side. So you can sort of start to think, well, this sounds like it's pretty easy, right? I mean, I know exactly solve what happens to the mode. So this is a set of input modes, A1 through AM. And I know what the outputs are in the sense that there's the exponential of this matrix. I can define a U, which is the exponential of this M. And this is the matrix that determines what happens. Right, so if I look at one of these modes, I discover that sort of U1 J, AJ, is the A output number one. And so on. This is just a matrix equation. Easy enough to solve. But if I wanted to know that I got, say, three photons here, two photons here, and none here, the probability of that actually turns out to be very complicated. So if you work out the case where there's, let's say there's three inputs and three outputs, well, there's different things that could happen, right? So they could go all together, like that. So that would be some U11, and U22, and a U33. They could also cross, say like this. So that would be a U12, a U21, and a U33. And now I can enumerate the other possibilities. And you'll see that there's six different ways that I can get these guys to hook up with each other. And they have a particular structure to them. They look like the elements of a determinant of a 3x3 matrix. Except there's one important thing. The probability of getting a particular output is the sum of all these guys, whole quantity squared. And the problem is that if I take the things that look like a determinant, but rather than subtracting antisymmetric pairs, I add them, you get this object that's called the permanent. It's like the determinant, except it is exponentially hard to evaluate. See, when you start subtracting things, lots of stuff cancels. And you can evaluate the determinant very rapidly. The permanent is provably hard to evaluate. In fact, evaluating is what's in this complexity class called sharp P. So for those of you who haven't heard about complexity classes, one thing we should start from the beginning. Things are complicated in general. In general, someone asks you some question and it's hard. But you wanted to quantify how hard. question is, well, you start developing some criterion for understanding hardness. You start to say, well, let's look at the dinner table problem. So we have a wonderful group of scientists, you know, but some people are friendlier than others. Some people have ongoing feuds. And so you set up a little diagram that says, well, you know, party A and party B can sit next to each other, but A can't sit next to C or D. And then you say, well, Ms. B is really interested in talking with item F, but not with Q and H. And when you have this series of clauses, set of conditions, and you ask, okay, so if I got everyone in the same room, can I actually sit them at a table? That's called a satisfiability problem. The one I just provided, where every clause has three elements to it, is called three sat. And in general, even answering the question, is it possible to sit down to dinner together without a feud erupting, is hard. So that is the class NP. In fact, that particular problem is what's called NP complete. It's the hardest class of NP problems. Okay, fine. Sharp P is not just answering, is it possible, but this is answering, so, is it possible? Sharp P is, how many ways is it possible? So, obviously, sharp P includes NP, simply because if you know the number of ways, then you know whether the number is 0 or greater than or equal to 1. And in fact, sharp P was defined when someone was looking at how hard it is to evaluate the permanent of a matrix. But it's turned out to be a very interesting complexity class in its own right. Now, a lot of what we like to think we do is that over here in P, polynomially satisfiable problems. And one of the great interesting features of quantum mechanics and quantum information is that there's a class between P and NP called BQP, which is like what you could do with a classical computer or with a quantum computer. So polynomial time, which means that it evaluates in time that is within our lifetime, but it requires the resources of a quantum computer. And this BQP problem turns out to have things in it that are very interesting, for example, simulation of molecules and factoring. What's really interesting is that this system, where it puts some photons in on the inside, they go through this beam splitter setup, and they come out the other side. And all they did was nothing. They said linear optics in between. That turns out to be a class somewhere around here, which is not yet fully defined, in which you can estimate, you can sample the permanence of this matrix. Because if you know where the photons came out, you end up getting an estimate of this permanent. And you repeat the experiment multiple times. And it seems that quantum devices can actually evaluate problems that are close to sharp P in time that is exponentially faster than what we knew how to do on a classical machine. So you can see actually that, okay, so I grew up in kind of an environment, let's say, with condensed matter physics being very interesting.
So this is not a sharp computer science result, because you have to estimate.
That's correct. Another way to say it is they'd have to define a new complexity class here that satisfies the definitions just found. But what we don't know is how deep into NP it is. Or if it just circumvents that entirely and sits over here in BQP. It seems likely to be in BQP, but we don't know for sure. Actually, it's one of the great things about working with complexity theorists. The one thing they're sure about is that they're unsure about anything. Okay. So I think, you know, the side point here is that even bosons are interesting. I used to think, oh, it was only fermions that were interesting. The bosons were easy. But actually, it turns out even bosons are hard. So having motivated that linear optics is not in and of itself not exciting, let's say. It has its own excitement. I now want to spend a bit of time.
Can you actually set up? So that's amusing.
Yeah.
Can you actually set up that? Set of mirrors and...
Oh, there's plenty of experimental groups.
You have, I'll say, M squared.
If you wanted to do this experimentally,
yeah.
This part in the middle here is easy. And I suspect there are several people in the room, because we have a few sort of... in quantum optics, we have this sort of thing where theorists are also experimentalists, which may be less familiar to those in other fields. So actually, I would be willing to bet that several people in the room could actually build a device that did this quite well for, say, up to 20 photons. Okay,
You just use
basically technology from telecommunications industry to do this. But the problem is, first of all, knowing you had n photons in the input, and second of all, measuring where they came out. And that's something that is much harder to solve. And there's been some recent progress on that, but let's say that it's very preliminary.
But how do you model the particular computational problem?
It's the choice of beam splitters in the middle. So the U, the matrix that you set up here, is determined by decomposition into linear optical elements that goes inside here. And that's an n squared problem, where n is the number of m squared problem. M is the number of inputs. Well, unitarity requires that I have no extra channels in these, right? So I can't hide some channels from you. That would be not playing the game properly. I would say in practice, no one's really going to do this. But it illustrates that even bosons turn out to be computationally hard in ways we didn't initially appreciate. That doesn't stop people from trying it anyway. I just think that it's a bit impractical in practice. So now I've motivated that photons can actually be quite interesting in their own right. And I'd now like to start to ask the question, okay, so we can maybe make photons interact. How far can we take it? And I was going to just provide two short case examples to see where we can go with this. And unfortunately, that means that there's a whole bunch of really interesting physics approaches and techniques that I'm not going to get much time to talk about. And so in lieu of talking about it in detail, I'm just going to sort of take a moment to mention some incredible things and then provide my examples of how we get to the many bodies plot. Okay, so we've gotten here. Now we're into many body ticks. I just want to mention some really neat things. So first of all, people have seen Bose-Einstein condensation and superfluidity. By combining excitons, these electron hole pairs, with photons. So these exciton polaritons. And there's a number of experts in the room who do that. This is going in very interesting ways. It's like looking at driven, damped versions of atomic systems. Actually, there's new opportunities to open, and where it goes, I don't yet know. There's some beautiful work where you get strong interactions. Between photons. Via what are called Rydberg atoms. So you may or may not recall that we used to think a long time ago, we not being anyone in the room, but we used to think a long time ago, you know, that the atom represented some core with something circulating around it. And it turns out if you go out to high enough quantum number, well, that's a good approximation. If you make the electron sufficiently excited, that's kind of what it does. And those type of states, atomic states, we call Rydbergs, because it looks like Rydberg's original picture of the atom. And these Rydberg states have a big separation between the nuclear core and that outermost electron circulating around. That means they've got a big charge differential, a big dipole. And that dipole-dipole interaction led to Michael Fleischer, among others, suggesting that, hey, this would be a great way to make photons interact. Because you have this photon comes in, it gets coupled to matter. This is this polariton mechanism. We'll describe it a bit more in a moment. And as it gets coupled to matter, it takes on some of the characteristics of the matter, so it can start to interact. And since these dipoles have huge, huge interaction strengths, that can immediately prevent the photon, a second photon rather, from making another such event. And it's a phenomenon called Rydberg blockade, leads to a phenomenon called photon blockade, But it also leads to beautiful physics. For example, the first observation of a bound state of light. Two photons chasing after each other in a medium, holding together the sort of quantum equivalent of what you might think a soliton is. Or three particle bound states, complexes of photons acting like a complicated molecule. Where this goes, we also don't know. It's extremely interesting physics. It's another big chunk of what we're doing.
Each excited state of a molecule is actually a bound state of light?
So you would say if this molecular binding potential has multiple levels allowed to it, which actually some of them don't, depends how deep it is.
Why do you need Bernoullis for that? If any molecule has the same feature, what's interesting about Rydberg?
Well, the question really is how light-like is the excitation? Is it like a photon? Or is it like the matter? And this is a question of how deeply you've mixed in the material degrees of freedom. So in these photonic molecules, it's primarily light-like. So it's a bit different in this regard. So if you want to hear about this, then tune your ears out for the next 20 minutes, because I'm not going to talk about it at all. It's beautiful physics, but I won't have time. Instead, I'm going to talk about a third domain of interest, which is called circuit QED. So I drew this picture. I don't know why I erased it. There's our cavity again. And now I'm going to do one thing to represent matter. I'm going to put a little system in here, which is a dipole, which has two states. Call it up, call it and down. Now you can ask, so the interaction between these two things is described by something which flips the spin of this dipole. This is flipping a spin up, destroying a photon. Flipping a spin down, creating a photon. So I can switch between a photon and a spin. Photon and a spin. This is called the James-Cummings interaction. And it has an interaction constant out front, which is this little g. Little g turns out to, from fundamental principles, have a nice form. If this is an electric dipole, then little g is given by the fine structure constant to the half. The experts will recognize this as the coupling constant in QED. And then I can compare the size of this dipole, which is something you might measure in Dubai, to what's called a Bohr dipole. So just a charge displaced by a Bohr radius. And then I look at a ratio, which is the wavelength of the light, the Bohr radius squared, divided by the volume in which the electric field is stored. And that's pretty much it. That's the fundamental principle of cavity quantum electrodynamics. How do you make... by the frequency of the photon. To give you some proper normalization. So, if you wanted to make the single dipole and this photon interact pretty strongly, well, you have to play with this equation. Okay, so the optimists can just wait and hope that alpha changes. Okay, unlikely, but you know, who knows? For the non-experts, this is this alpha is 1 over 137, roughly speaking. It's this sort of famous nearly numerological constant. One thing you can do is you can make this dipole big. That helps a lot. So Serge Haroche, rather than working with optical dipoles that turn out to be pretty small, he worked with these Rydberg atoms with microwave cavities. And that let him get a really big dipole in here, and through this series of very beautiful experiments that eventually won him the Nobel Prize. The third thing you can do is you can try to play around with the volume, the size of this cavity. And here's where life gets very fun. So as you probably remember from your introductory electromagnetism, you can't store light surrounded by a dielectric in a region smaller than the wavelength cubed. Right? The light has to sort of fit somewhere on the boundaries of the dielectric, and that's the consequence. So normally you would think that this VE was restricted to be wavelength cubed, and for dielectric, it is. But, as anyone who's used a piece of coaxial cable knows, if you put metals into the equation, this is no longer true. If I have a centerline conductor, I can solve boundary equations differently. And that lets me make a piece of coaxial cable, a little centerline and some thing around it like this, whose length might be the wavelength that makes a resonator, but the width here is limited primarily by breakdown of your material, screening lengths, sort of physical criterion of what makes the metal a metal. And so you can actually start to play a very fun game now, in which by using a metal, you can dramatically reduce this volume and thus dramatically increase this G. So this is what's called circuit QED. Now, if that's all you did, you would still actually be in pretty tough shape, because metals, as we know, are lossy. But physics has a solution, which is superconductivity. So if you take a metal and you cool it down, what you discover is that the electrons interact with each other, not for every metal, but for some. Electrons interact with each other via the vibrations of the lattice. And they can bind weakly. And eventually, they form their own condensate of electrons, which is this BCS wave function. And this state of matter is vastly different than what you had before. In particular, it has zero resistance. It's a superconductor. It has some other properties as well, which we're going to use in a moment. But the superconductivity is very nice, because it means that you get, just like with these of the dielectric, where you almost have no losses and the photons can travel for long times, in superconductors, the excitations of electromagnetism, Maxwell's equation solutions, can propagate over very long distances through the superconductor. Now, I say it this way because you ask, what's a photon? Well, a photon is the thing you detect. What's the thing you detect? Well, it's the excitations, in this case, of the circuit. But it's still a photon. So, the other thing that circuit QED buys you, and this is really the non-trivial part. So yeah, I made the cavity really small. I now have strong interactions with materials. I can do beautiful physics, get the Nobel Prize.
How small, how strong?
Well, that's an important question. So far, people have gotten this to about that number. So about 0.08, 0.07, 0.08. But it seems likely that they could get to of order one if you could solve some microwave engineering challenges. So
that sounds amazing. So the area is nanometers? Less nanometers?
Well, you know, there's a cheat here, right? So I've got a bore radius here and a bore radius here.
Yeah,
so those cancel out.
Okay, so you use Rydberg atoms.
So, well, no, what you do is you use circuits instead.
Well, what is D in the circuit?
You make a big antenna with a Josephine junction. So I have a big antenna, resonant circuit, and I have a Josephine device, which I'll explain in just a moment. And this big antenna has a dipole element, and it sits between, say, the central line of a conductor and the ground plane. So it's filling the volume with a dipole element here, which is comparable to the square root of the area there, and that's how you get close to one. This type of device is what is called a transmon qubit. And John Martinez, who until very recently was here at UCSB, you know, left to go to Google in order to take transmons to the next level. Now he has what's called gmons, but anyway. That's not fundamentally important. What is fundamentally important is that there are two cheats superconductivity allows you. The first cheat is you get zero resistance. But the second cheat is much more important. And the second cheat is that the vacuum is dramatically different in the superconductor than it is in the vacuum. You've changed the underlying state of matter in a fundamental way. And that allows you to make very, very strong interactions. And in particular, the thing that we use is called a Josephine effect. So if you go back to your introductory circuit class, where you first learned about inductors and capacitors, you probably remember that if I take an inductor and a capacitor, that I get a harmonic circuit. It's an oscillator. It goes back and forth And the variables here turn out to be charge on the capacitor, and this variable, which is flux through this inductor, which you can understand in terms of EMF, you can understand in terms of current. So in a superconductor, when I have a piece of material, a small insulating region, and then another piece of material, the superconductor has actually a defined phase, which is the flux quantity here. And it has another phase here. And as you go across it, you get an inductance that looks like the sort of sine of the phase difference. And if I think of this in potential energy space, an inductor has an energy that looks like the flux squared divided by the inductance. A Josephine device is an energy which goes as a Josephine energy times the cosine of the phase difference. So you'll notice that if I take a cosine and I expand it about small fluctuations of flux, I get a quadratic. Right? So a Josephine device looks locally like an inductor. But it's a cosine. And if you make the flux fluctuations large, all bets are off. So as an example of a neat trick you can do, this is something that this is now getting into my personal research, right? So we're only in the last few minutes here, so I think it's OK. One thing that you can do with these Josephine devices is you can make photons interact in ways that matter would never allow. Like, for example, we dreamed up a way that you could describe a system. So I'm going to draw a potential. This is V as a function of flux. And you can make a potential which looks, remember, there's a cosine, right? So you have these wiggles in it. And if I quantize this thing, I start to get energy levels. And you'll notice that I can have a little bound state over here, which couples to this guy via tunneling. And so you can get a strong non-perturbative effect in the spectrum. So normally the excitations of this harmonic oscillator look like photons until you get right near this resonance. And that allows you to actually engineer the system so that the one photon looks like a photon. Two photons look like two photons. But three photons are different. And so you can, from this, make an interaction which looks sort of like a delta function between three photons. Even though there's no two-photon interaction at all. You can add now on top of this some neat tricks, which are called synthetic gauge fields, and I don't have time to go into it, where in which you make the, remember I said you can basically control how the photon propagates? Well, one of the things you can do is you can make the photon feel like it has a magnetic field. As in, it looks like a charged particle magnetic field. It gets cyclotron orbits, and Mamad Hafezi has demonstrated how you do this experimentally. So you can add to this, then, magnetic field. And if I just had one more component, which was fixed photon number, some people may recognize these are the ingredients for what's generating a fractional quantum Hall state. So we know how to do this. We know how to do this. And now I'll tell you briefly that you can actually do this too. It's not really fixed, but rather that you can achieve a grand canonical ensemble for light. And the idea is very simple. So I have to take you back to your introductory thermodynamics, where you said, well, I have some system described by Hamiltonian. I have some bath. And then I have some coupling between them. And you'll say, well, I don't care how the system starts. Let me look at the long time limit. Let me look at what happens at very long times. And for systems that thermalize, it's worth mentioning that sort of half the participants in the room are very interested in questions about systems that don't thermalize. But for systems that thermalize, you find that the description of the system is given by what's called the density matrix. And in the long time limit, this density matrix just becomes e to the minus. If this starts in some temperature 1 over beta, the whole thing goes to a temperature, a density matrix of the system, and the bath and the system bath coupling. And then if you're careful about taking your limits, you can take the limit as lambda goes to 0 after you take the limit of time to infinity, and you take the trace over the bath of the system, and you discover that the rho system is just e to the minus beta h over the partition function, which is to say that it goes to the microcanonical ensemble, or the canonical ensemble, rather. So this is thermalization in three lines, and if you didn't like it, I can't really help you. It turns out that there's a lot of open questions about this all in itself, and I encourage you to go to the NBL Chalk Talk when it happens to get the details on that. But you can modify this a little bit. So what we thought about was, what if I take this and I replace it with something that's oscillating in time? Well, that sounds like a disaster. It's a driven system. How could it thermalize? You can put some constraints on this thing. You can say, well, what if the bath doesn't have any response at this frequency? You know, so the bath is, the system-bath interaction is some coupling of positions of items in the system, positions of items in the bath. Maybe if I tug on this bath oscillator, it doesn't respond at the pump frequency, at this new peak. In fact, we can generate baths like that. In which case, I can say, but maybe the system does respond at that frequency. So let me make a rotating frame where this thing is oscillating at the pump frequency. I'll just put a momentum term in here. And the momentum is the same thing. And then you'll see that there's some terms in this cosine, which line up. And if you average over a cycle, they're on the order of a half. And there's some terms, like the sine times the cosine, which averages to 0. And in the limit where the bath doesn't respond near new pump, I can make what's called the rotating wave approximation, where I neglect this sine term. But when I moved to this rotating frame, I also added a term to the Hamiltonian, because I'm in a rotating frame, which is of the form new pump times something we'll call a dagger a, which is the number operator, the number of photons that are in the system. So the whole thing now looks like H system minus new a dagger a plus H bath plus now order lambda, because this averaged out to a half, times this sum of system operators and bath operators, which is the system-bath interaction. So I follow through the same thermalization argument, and I discover that the system goes to e to the minus beta H system minus new a dagger a. And you recognize this as the grand canonical ensemble. So you can, in the thermodynamic limit, recover something like photon number conservation.
How can you make it in practice?
I have enough time to answer that question. Good. So the trick is, I want my system, first of all, I want it to interact with the bath. I want it to be in an open system environment. But I want that coupling to be oscillating in time. Now, one trick for doing that is going back to circuits. Remember this Josephine term here? Well, if you're clever with the Josephine effect, you can actually have two junctions in parallel and thread some flux through this thing. And then you get, rather than, you get a cosine of the phase difference times the cosine of the external flux threading through the system. Now, if over here this system is hooked up to an infinite transmission line, also known as an ohmic bath or a resistor, and over here this is hooked up to some interesting system that eventually goes down to ground, this thing here can oscillate in time with a time-dependent drive. Now, this is a gesture at how you really build the system. We have a much more complicated and, I think, more robust approach than this. But the crucial point is, I can make a time-dependent coupling by modulating the parameters of this circuit. Please.
You're treating the photons as if neglecting their spin.
Yes. So in
okay.
Well, if you think of these circuits as waveguides, then you know in a waveguide structure, the TE and TM get broken down. And in fact, there's all sorts of relief on physics that arise, even with dielectrics, when you're in very small structures, which leads to some sort of chiral phenomenon that was actually quite unexpected, even though if you look at Maxwell's equations in 1880, you would have seen it, right? But we got blinded to it to some extent. So Arno Ruschfeld, who was here 2 weeks ago, gave a beautiful talk on this, actually. So if it is true, I'm neglecting this polarization degree of freedom for the photons. And again, in these dielectric media, in these circuits, that's actually for good reasons, because the different boundary conditions lead to different polarization behaviors. So the point, though, is that making a time-dependent coupling in the system is actually relatively straightforward in these superconducting circuit cases, and we have some other approaches to the optical domain, but okay, I don't really have time to go into it. So I've told you just a little bit. And actually, I had something else I wanted to go into, but you know, we're out of time. So at this point, I would really just like to encourage your questions and comments and concerns. And yeah, thank you for your time.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand quite this idea of having a gap in the bus spectrum.
Yes.
Because in addition to resonance absorption, there are all kinds of other processes like multi-phonon, whatever, there is parametric resonance. So your rotating wave approximation is not so good approximation if you are coupled to the bus. And if this coupling is very small, then you don't have thermalization. So what are conditions, if there are window or not?
So there's a weak coupling hierarchy you have to satisfy in order for this rotating wave approximation to be good. And certainly, if I don't eventually go to the true weak coupling limit, where the coupling goes to zero, I can make no guarantee about the multi-photon processes. In practice, you never really gap out the bath. Instead, what you have is a non-equilibrium system. Okay, so you have the part that's being upconverted, which is what we call maybe a parametric bath. But then you have some other stuff you couldn't get rid of, which is the regular bath. And so there's actually a competition. And I really like to draw this out as a sort of diagram that would make the Guinness matter physicist happy, which is you basically have some system, and over here you have some chemical potential. But because I can't gap out the bath response at all frequencies, I also have over here a vacuum. And so I can couple to the system this way within the rotating wave approximation, and I get some counter-rotating effects which or leakage out into the vacuum here. So you could recognize this as a finite bias applied to a non-photonic system. And so it's not equilibrium, but in the limit where this, call this kappa, call this gamma, where kappa is very small compared to gamma, you can get close to equilibrium. So the system will equilibrate near this chemical potential, but not exactly.
But what about rotating wave approximation? Will it be valid here or not?
Oh, I'm saying you can actually capture all of the corrections from rotating wave in this coupling.
Okay. You mentioned again polariton in the context of Bose-Einstein condensation. I just want to make
a comment. Fluidity, yeah.
Photons are not necessary for this. And the fact is even bad, because when you talk about this polariton in this microcavity, the polariton which condense are essentially photons. So it is still a debate to know what it is. Actually, it's possible to get condensate of pure excitons, and this has been missed for decades, but recently seen. The problem is that his mention is that you have polarization effect, and the excitons which condense are not coupled to light. So people have looked at the condensate of polariton as something bright, and it turned out that when you look at the condensate as something dark, you see it. So condensate of excitons now exists for the last 2 years have been seen, And but when you talk about polaritons, there's a trouble because the object which condenses is essentially a photon. And in this context of having interaction, is not a good guy because it's you know, in order to have a strong interaction, you need to have an exciton leg which is strong, because through the exciton leg, the two polaritons can interact. And in the Condorcet, this is opposite. You have the essentially a photon.
Yes.
At the moment, they condense. It is 99% or something. Of course, they claim they have seen it because they're happy with it, but okay. It's still a debate about it. But
yes.
Condorcet of exciton now has been seen that the exciton condense in a dark state, not coupled to light, which is not nice for this conference.
Oh, no. I think, you know, the complexity is welcomed. And say complexity is welcomed. Actually, there's some interesting effects if you have if you have a dark polariton.
You cannot have dark polaritons. You can because there's coupled to light. The excitons are bright and dark, and only the bright coupled to light. But the warm condens are dark. So they are not polaritons.
Yes. So the point is that life can become very interesting if you put in the background, for example, exciton structure to the system in similar ways that I've already intimated, that by changing the underlying meaning of the vacuum, you change how things behave. But I think that actually where this goes with the excitons and exciton polaritons remains a bit under investigated. So we'll have to see where it goes.
Thank you, Jake.